Already we have started chatting. It's going to be excellent. It's Annie Siddons returning. The show is returning to the Soho Theater.
Yeah.
How not to live in suburbia.
Yep.
Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Annie Siddons.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Tell us about the show.
Okay, so the show is a hilarious, brutal and poignant look at chronic loneliness. And it's autobiographical, so it's based on my own experiences. And it's kind of a cross between comedy, theatre and live art. It's got lots of videos in it. It's got two performers in it, me and my friend Nikki, who plays me. So that's what you get. And it's an hour, it's a good night out at the theatre about loneliness.
If you can get there.
If you can get to Soho. And it's, for us, it's amazing to be doing it in W1, in the heart of London, because, among other things, it's a love letter to my city, which is changing so much at the moment, kind of morphing at a dizzying and slightly disturbing way. But I identify very strongly as a Londoner. And so partly it's high-fiving my city. But, you know, we're taking the show on tour and we've taken it on tour, and it does speak to people who aren't kind of rabid Londoners, because it's about the theme of loneliness and love and parenting and belonging and community and all of those things.
Yeah, because I found... Okay, so it spoke to me... The idea of it spoke to me very strongly, because I, as you can hear, am a New Yorker.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a baby, and I had moved all of my friends to Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Even literally on the same street.
Yeah.
And then I had a baby, and in 6 months, baby 6 months old, I don't know who I was.
Yeah, sure.
Moved to London, where I knew no one.
Wow, that's a big one.
It was dumb. But I also found early motherhood wildly isolating.
Yeah, it definitely is. It's crazy isolating. Yeah. And I think, I mean, one of the things that's been interesting about making the show is that the conversation around mental health generally has opened up so much in the media, I'd say, in the last 5 years. But the conversation, when I started making the show, which was this time 3 years ago, I made the decision to make the show, the conversation about loneliness wasn't happening. It was happening in one very specific regard, which was, oh, the old are lonely.
Old people are lonely.
Which was, I think, our way collectively of going, that's not me, that's not me, that's not me, because it was too painful. And what I found was, once I'd realised I was lonely, which took a while, because I was like, what is... Can
what
I
is
swear
it?
On this?
Or yes, not? You can.
What the fuck's wrong with me? What? Why do I feel this way? What is it? Because this feels different from anything else. I'd identified it as loneliness, and I sort of casually tried dropping the L-bomb into conversations. And these are friends, you know, we work in the arts, we're open, curious people. The response was so cringe and so awkward and so embarrassed, and that was also a spur to make the show, because I thought we kind of need to have this conversation. We need to have it. And as
because you're lame for being lonely.
Yeah.
They're super shame. Like, what's wrong with you?
Yeah, exactly. And I think a lot of that is just a miscomprehension of what loneliness is. But also, in the way of things, since 3 years ago when I started making the show, the conversation about loneliness has opened up massively in the media. So I just feel now that I'm just part of that conversation, mm-hmm. which is a really great place to be, because obviously I don't have all the answers. I'm just offering one very subjective perspective. And I did some reading very late in the process, because I didn't want it to be one of those shows where an artist has Googled something and then made it, you know, I hate those shows. But I just wanted to check in with what the phenomenon of loneliness was deemed to be by certain academics. And on reading it, I was like, holy fuck, like, I am a female ape who has been subjected to certain conditions, therefore is lonely. And it was such a relief to kind of feel that I was just behaving as any human ape would behave subjected to these conditions. It was kind of oddly reassuring. So
I was because I think I put, I mean, it's just sitting here with you now, I could not put my finger on that.
Yeah.
I put it down to I cannot like anyone or anything if I don't have enough sleep. Like,
yeah.
The world is black and hateful, and I want to murder people. It's not personal.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm just murderously
yeah,
rageful.
Just a murderous spree yeah, without any
exactly.
personal...
No,
yeah,
yeah. Not, you know, just mowing people
yeah,
down,
just
you know,
a classic
kind of
mow down.
But, or postpartum-y,
yeah.
but not full, and then there's shame in that.
There's so much shame.
And
shame is the... You know, the
primary,
the twin.
Yeah. And I, but it's literally only talking to you. It's like, yes, I was deeply, deeply lonely.
Yeah.
And I like spending a lot of time by myself.
Well, me too. I'm a writer, for fuck's sake. It's not like I'm scared to be alone. I happen to be a writer who's on the very extrovert end of, I think, if you put 20 playwrights in a room, I'd probably be at the most outgoing end of it because I'm also a performer. But I'm fine with solitude. I don't... It's not like I can't be alone with my thoughts. It's not that at all. It's everything else. So, yeah, it's been interesting figuring it out. And I think, hopefully for the show... People have come up to me after the show and gone, my husband or my boyfriend or my girlfriend or my mum is lonely. And I haven't understood why she's been behaving the way she's been behaving. But now I do. So if I can do that a little bit, plus giving people a great night of showbiz, then I feel I'm doing
razzle dazzle.
Yeah, then I feel like I'm doing my job properly mm-hmm. because it's just as much lonely people behave weirdly, right?
Mm-hmm.
We do. So and now I understand the science of that even. So it must be very perplexing for it's like you're on one side of the bridge or the other side of the bridge as a non-lonely person. Looking at the behaviours of...
Why are you acting so aggressive? And...
Yeah, why are you being so hostile? Why are you being so sensitive? And I think that's really important to name. So I'm hoping to have, like, a hand of solidarity with the lonely, but also to kind of explain us to those who are in the fortunate position of not being, which doesn't mean that they never will be, but they just... haven't been yet, or they're in denial, which is the other thing.
You're just a six pack away from being lonely.
Yeah, because it's weird.
Well, it could
it?
Happen to yeah. anyone. It really. I think any mental health. You know, when I'm happy, I'm just like I'm noticing this. I'm enjoying this.
Yeah.
I don't know where it came from, and it could be plucked away from me at any time.
Yeah.
Just enjoy it.
Exactly.
You know, like, really notice it, wallow around in it, because there, for the grace of God, go we. You know,
exactly, yeah.
The next day, who knows what's going to plunge, you know, plunge me into an inability to reach out.
Yeah.
A feeling of shame.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we don't know.
We don't know. No, you're right.
And we are all a hell of a lot more fragile than we care to believe.
Yeah, we definitely are. And I think some... I think with the whole... With me, I had a real, like... I wanted to be a good single mother. I wanted to be someone who was nailing it as a single mum.
No pressure, then.
So, yeah, I mean, ridiculous. Like, ridiculous. And, you know, I think... And
you didn't hear about that good enough parenting thing?
Well, that's in the show. That's in the show, actually. But, you know, it felt like such a... Because of my background, where I come from, leaving my marriage was a big... Ooh, you know, it was a big thing. It shouldn't be in the era that we're in, but it was a big thing. And so I felt an extra pressure to really nail that shit and to prove to everyone that I was nailing it. And that was already kind of where the problems started because... You know, being proud, setting this ridiculously high bar for myself was already setting me up for a massive fall because it's hard. It's really hard. And when you're trying to macho it out as well, and just you know, because I have a feckless bohemian lifestyle doesn't mean that I can't also parent the fuck out of my mm-hmm. children and make them delicious, happy human beings, which I've obviously failed to do, but that's another. But, you know, it's, I'd already set up a system in which I was destined to fail. But,
well, and also you had also prejudged yourself. You know, you've already said, well, I'm bohemian, so like I'm not going to fit in here. You've already put yourself in a, you're already putting yourself behind something.
Yeah, although that is borne out with evidence. You know, that's not me kind of going, ooh, I'm so different. That's just mm-hmm. how it is here and generally, I think, as well. So, yeah.
As with us human apes, we see difference. You know, yeah. We are trained.
We train to see difference. Yeah, exactly.
So how did you end up, because we're sitting in your, you know, lovely suburban home.
But isn't my home fucking lovely and warm and like, uh-huh. I'm very proud of this home and I'm proud of how warm and welcoming and shabby and homey mm-hmm. it is. It just happens to be in the wrong place. But it's a classic story. So I was married and my then husband got a job. We'd been living in Bristol for 2 years. And then he got a job back. Before that, we'd lived all around different proper London places. So the last place we'd lived before moving out to Bristol was kind of Stoke Newington, Stamford Hill borders, which I fucking loved. And then we moved to Bristol. And then he got a job in Hammersmith, actually. So I tried to find us a place in Hammersmith, but I had to find a school for my daughter. And finding the school took me out and 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 out until I landed up here in Zone 5 where there was a school place for her. So it was a decision that was made entirely from the part of me that was being a grown-up, responsible, supportive wife and brilliant mother. And I didn't really factor into that decision at all.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, that's what I meant by, like, you're putting yourself in a place behind. Because you weren't, you know, like, you can't stuff yourself. You can't put baby in the corner for forever.
No, and I think I had underestimated just how monocultural this area was. I didn't quite understand it because it's ostensibly London after all. And yet...
No sound.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, now we know that, 11 years after the fact. Now we know that. But I honestly thought, oh, it'd be fine. It's still London. You know, it'll be cool. And then slowly I began to notice things. And even while I was married, you know, I was noticing. But he was never around anyway because he's a workaholic, which is one of the reasons why the marriage didn't work, you know. So I was left... in
alone.
1950s Pleasantville with my two kids. And I feel like I need to do a disclaimer because I have lots of really good friends that I've met since being here. But they're all the same. They're all white, middle class, university educated, nuclear families. And that's where the problem is for me. I love these people. I have really good individual friendships, but for me it's not a community because there's not enough interruptions to that narrative. There's too much conversation about extensions, private school, you know, all that. I have no fucking interest in any of that. Didn't when I was married. Had to politely nod and go, you know, but now I'm not, you know, I'm absolutely not, I'm not on the same track. We're not on the same path at all. So... yeah, it gradually started to drip into a sort of slow, corrosive feeling of wrongness.
Displacement.
Yeah, and it's not... it's very white, this area, and it's very... I then looked at the census, and it is the most married place in London, the least gay place and the least black place. And for me to be happy, I need to be around lots of gay people, lots of black people, and lots of people who are young, old. There are no people between 25 and 35 either. So that it's a very strange demographic.
It's a weird, yeah. It feels so skewed. But yeah. Then I suppose if you're here, then you're here for that, but you weren't here for that. It's, yeah, I would find it very, very disorienting. And then if you like that, then you can't leave that.
Mm.
Because nowhere else is like this.
No, and yeah. Also, you know, I mean, I... Part of the more accessible parts of the show is that I do lay into suburbia and the tropes of living here, because they're, you know, they're easy to skewer, it's funny, and if you're not in it, it just looks like very strange behaviour, like the compulsive sportiness, for instance, is really alien to me. Like, do you really need to do another fucking triathlon? Like, why are you doing so many triathlons in such expensive running, you know, all of that is easy to skewer, but so you can take it as a light kind of satire on the ridiculousness of suburban mores, but also it leads narratively to me being in quite a dark place, and I'm not a pussy, you know, it's not like, oh, poor me, I don't fit in. It's like what happened over a long period of time, the slow drip, 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 and also that, you know, the people that I love were either... So, we prioritise the nuclear family in this... Unless we're in some kind of queer art collective. Which means that, you know, people prioritise their husbands and their children. Which is what I did when I was married. And that's normal. But what it means is that if you have delicious heterosexual married female friends, you come, like, way down their list of priorities. Because they're negotiating two families... two jobs,
mm-hmm.
So much narrative in that, and you can't necessarily skewer that or get in amongst it. So there's that. Then there's the fact that a lot of my art friends are obviously living in Southeast, which shouldn't be a problem, but is, because it's fucking miles away and transport and childcare. So, you know, I go over all this in the show. I sort of analyse it very forensically and hilariously.
we might
just drop in, but it is important to me that I always make shows that sit in the really uncomfortable place between extreme hilarity and extreme pain. Like someone said my shows are bipolar, which I thought was very insensitive in the use of that word, but also true, because I sit in the dark and light corner at the same time. And I'm proud. You know, for me, that's a representation of reality. So...
And how do you then... I mean, was... The choice about making the show...
Yeah.
Why, you know, why 3 years ago? And also why, you know, why make it autobiographical? Why...
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question, because I'm not an autobiographical artist. But I think, so when my kids were young, I worked purely as a playwright because it fitted in around their soft play schedules. And, you know, it just worked better. But I've always had a performance background and a making background, and I had always had a tug to go back to that at some point. And then in 2013, I made my first show in that way, which was called Raimondo, which was me and a guitarist on stage. And it was like a delicious adult fairy tale about two brothers who get locked in a cellar by their mother and then escape and have adventures in the world. And it went really, really well. And I loved being in front of an audience so much. I felt like I'd come home, and it was delicious. But I noticed that because I'd couched it in this sort of magic realist idiom, a lot of the content of the show, which was really hard-hitting, serious stuff, that I'd say about half the people who saw it, it completely passed them by because of the idiom of it, which interested me and kind of annoyed me a bit. The other half got it, but, you know, I was interested in how the form could kind of betray the content in a way. For me, it was just a way of talking about very big stuff in a way that wouldn't betray anyone that I knew, or you know, give rise to speculation. Or
it was a way back in for you.
It was a way back in, but also specifically wanting to talk about certain things, but not wanting to talk about certain people in my life. And I think I do experience the world in this kind of magic realist way. I had another interview with someone who asked me about it, and I think it is just how I experience, you know, the grotesque next to the beautiful just feels like realism to me rather than
normal
magic realism. But I did feel that there was, I'd gotten so far in my connection with an audience, but there was still something that was missing, and I, at the same time, was starting to have these conversations about loneliness with friends, which were an absolute fucking disaster. You know, total tumbleweed.
Crickets.
And these are people who I've spoken about their postnatal depression. You know, it's incredible. You can talk about mental illness, but loneliness, which isn't a, it's not in the DSM. It's not in the DSM 4 or even 5. Even though everything else, you know, just being a human being is in the DSM-5, but loneliness isn't. And the shame and the awkwardness just impelled me to go, right, fuck it, I have to make this into a show. Because often I make shows about things that I can't have chats about. That's kind of the motivation with everything is, you know, if I could have a little chat about it, I wouldn't need to make the art about it. It's about the things that are too complex and gnarly to have a WhatsApp conversation about or whatever. So those two things kind of came together in a delicious pincer movement that just kind of impelled me to make the show. And then that summer I was up in Edinburgh with Raimondo, and I was up on this incredible curated scheme of artists, which was brilliant for me because I hadn't been in Edinburgh for like 20 years. So I knew no one, I knew nothing, and then suddenly I had this ready-made art family, which was amazing, and I met lots of people there that I really wanted to collaborate with. And one of them was this, I call him an art imp, because he kind of transgresses boundaries. It's this guy called Richard de Domenici, who makes, he's kind of known in the art world for making redux films, so he remakes films, thus skewering the conventions of the industry, etc., etc. And he was employed as the Twitter czar of this scheme. So we became friendly, and I realised that he had a similar kind of passion for London and for cities as I did, and that he was a brilliant filmmaker. So that kind of just fell into place, and I asked him to make some films with me. And then flyering on the steps very ineffectually of Summer Hall, which is where Raimondo was, I met a woman called Nikki who was flyering. I was flyering ineffectually, and she was flyering very petulantly.
Take it.
And we became firm friends. But in that kind of Edinburgh way where you just see people around and give them a hug and you're really pleased to see them, but I never thought I'd see her again after Edinburgh. Then I realised I needed someone to play all the other women except for me. And I'd never seen her perform, but I just, from her petulant flyering, I knew that she'd be an excellent performer. And so she came and played all the other women, and other people were involved. And so it just sort of happened like that, but it took ages. It took, well, 3 years since its inception now. We've done it already. Like, it was finished this time last year, so it took 2 years to make. So it's been, you know, a really good journey, I think. And I'm not suddenly going to be an autobiographical artist. Like, it's not my vibe, and I hate pretty much 97% of autobiographical work, because I think it can leave audiences in a very vulnerable position of feeling that they've just had someone else's shit smeared all over them, and then they're left to get the Jubilee line home alone to their lives. So I have lots of rules and kind of ethics about how an autobiographical show could be, which we've tried to really rigorously,
the rights and responsibilities.
Tried to interrogate it, and Nikki's been absolutely, she has a forensic outside eye, and she's been really good at working out how we could do that. But the show's had lots of iterations. Like, there was a really terrible iteration which I call the pants iteration, where I kind of get naked, and I was doing a lot of acting, and it was fucking terrible. It was terrible. I'm so glad the show is.
I'm so glad I don't have to get on the Piccadilly after that.
Yeah, and then we realised that if
it's
we...
It's unfair.
It would have been irresponsible and also not what I was trying to do, which is not like, poor me, I'm lonely, was never the aim of the show. So what we've done is divided the roles so that I take you through the show. I kind of narrate the show. And she does all the acting bits, which gives you a kind of a really considered separation between what we do. And also gives you a little bit of distance so that you're not worried about me while all that's mm-hmm. going on. And I think that's our best shot. And I think it works. Because I haven't had too many people come up to me afterwards going, "You okay, babes?" Which is the thing that I really didn't want to happen. I have, however, had some good friends come up to me going, "I feel shit about myself now because I feel like I wasn't there for you." And I feel a bit sad for that because that was never my intention in making the show, was to make my really gorgeous friends feel shit about themselves. And I hope that they understand that. Also, it's art, so, you know, it's not 100% factual is another thing. I mean, my loneliness is a walrus. Mm. And like I had to explain to Libby Purves, that is a metaphor.
It's not an actual walrus.
I mean, it was effectively, but you know, we're already working in an idiom where my loneliness is a walrus and my shame is a seal. So ergo, surely you can see that maybe not everything is 100% as it is described, yeah. That there might be a little bit of license for narrative clarity, say, or humour, or, you know, hitting a point hard. So, but, you know, I'm hoping that they'll figure that out in time.
Tell me, because for me it's also, suburbia is a place, it's a displace, but it's also... It speaks a lot about identity and lack of identity and having made choices, not considering, you know, there were four people involved and one person wasn't considered, that person being yourself.
Yeah.
But then after 11 years, I mean, like, I still pretend I'm a New Yorker. I've lived here for 12 years. My New York doesn't exist. I'm not a New Yorker. My relationship with my husband has happened more in London than it ever did in New York.
Yeah.
It's, you know, my son, yeah, he was born in Brooklyn, but, you know, 11 and a half out of the 12 years...
He's been here.
He is here. My husband's English. Yeah. It's, you know what I mean? He moved to New York for a time. You know, at what point, you know, like the Japanese temple that they remake every year is the oldest temple. At what point does it become, you know, a new temple or a different, you know, at what point... Is your identity twicking them? But you know what I mean. But you have been changed by this. You have been formed. You have, you know, as everything else. And how do you approach that in your mind?
I don't think I do.
Shit.
I mean, I still. What I haven't done is I haven't become someone who does triathlons. I was expelled from the book group, as is in, you know, so I tried a little bit and then I was like, nah, this isn't, there's a lot of this that isn't for me. And the integrity of that is important to me, and that's part of the show as well, that, you know, and it's not some kind of torch song of standing alone bravely, and yet it sort of is. But I'm not, you know, if you live in Twickenham and you're listening to this and you're like, well, I'm a potter, I'm really, you know, I mean, I know that you're out there. I know that you're out there, but there's just not enough of us. And the rugby narrative, for instance, I mean, fuck me. Like, this must be what it's like living in Edinburgh in August when you hate the arts with a passion and you hate artists and you hate comedians and you hate people painted silver giving you out flyers. Because I resent the rugby narrative. I have absolutely cock all interest in rugby. And this is a very specific southern British thing where rugby in southern Britain is an elitist, has been pretty homophobic and misogynist up until recently. It's not now. But there's a whole like set of class things going on, hypermasculinity. I'm not rugby. But rugby imposes itself on me way more than I would like it to. And
on match days, you can't move around here.
Exactly. You can't move. People vomit in your garden. Yeah. People grope you. You know, people in animal onesies piss, you know.
All up the 316. Yeah.
Which is weird because on one level, I'm like, that's a bacchanal.
Sort of that's anarchic a carnival. And funny.
It should be. But the thing is, it's in service of this massive corporate, masculine, upper class, heteronormative sport that I have cock all interest in. And I really resent that. I resent it. You know, like, I don't want any part of it. And, you know, I've got friends who've got, just fucking when in Rome, mate. You know, just get on board with it. But I can't. I can't.
No.
So I don't, you know.
Well, and so clearly rugby's not the answer, the cure to loneliness.
It is for some people, though.
It is.
And good for them, you know. Like,
but not for you. What did anything pull you out of that? Because everything is what you imbue it with. And, like, if you're feeling like shit, then you have a shit filter and you look for more shit. You look for
this is
evidence of crap. When you're in a great mood, you're looking at all the sunny
exactly.
stuff. You're like,
exactly.
isn't that beautiful? Isn't that, you know, so everything's what you're imbued. So when you have your loneliness head on, you're seeing evidence, you're collecting evidence
all
this
the time. This is so true. And it's really important for people to understand that. And I think that hasn't really been talked about. You know, that, you know, there's a bit in the show where I say loneliness breeds loneliness because
Absolutely.
You get yourself into that mindset.
Yes.
And I think, you know, if you love or care for someone who's lonely, it's helpful for you to understand that. And there's, you know, scientifically, there's a thing that happens cognitively to you where you start to, your kind of social threat perceptions get completely out of line. So any interaction that is neutral, you perceive as hostile and threatening.
Mm-hmm.
And every interaction that is positive, you can only perceive as neutral. So you get yourself stuck in this self-perpetuating lonely loop that is really hard to break out of.
I was going to say, how do you break out of that? And
I
how
think,
do you help somebody break out of that?
Well, naming that and owning it is, I think, so powerful because I certainly have gone, was that neighbour really a dick to me? Or, you know, check in. No, they actually weren't, you know.
Like
was,
that was actually okay. That was fine. They were just doing their thing and I was doing that. Okay, yeah.
And I feel really lucky because I'm really gregarious and I work in the arts and I have lots of amazing friends. So I think it's easier for me than maybe for some other people. But I think realising that loneliness is a state and it isn't depression, but it can tip into depression very easily. So you are if you're lonely, you become a million times more vulnerable. You become vulnerable to depression, to addiction, to not looking after yourself. So you kind of, if you're lonely, you kind of need to get on the whole self-care thing, I think, and be kind at a time where you probably don't feel like being kind because you're ashamed.
So much anger. Like, I think anger and aggression are sort of that, you know, the product of swallowing that shame, you know, comes out in vile invective.
I mean, especially with the sort of trope of the malicious, hostile, lonely old man or woman, you know,
cranky,
the boogie.
Yeah,
and then that makes
grumpy,
so much sense,
cranky,
you know.
Yeah,
it
exactly.
makes so much sense because if there's no one to burst that bubble for them, then. But I think
fuck me, fuck you.
The way we communicate has a lot to answer for. I think, you know, I deal with this a lot in the show, the sort of casualness, now we're all online all the time, the casualness of changing arrangements or cancelling or, you know.
Oh, Dexter, I'm in the middle of an interview.
If you... so that casualness, which is, we all do it, can be absolutely brutal to someone who is in the throes of loneliness. So there, I think kind of raising awareness of those things is important. Also, the shame element. So until recently, if you went to your doctor, I found this out because we did this brilliant symposium where we got loads of academics together who were research psychologists who were looking at the phenomenon of loneliness. And we kind of met in this big kind of delicious carnival of art meets science. And they showed us all their findings and it was open to the public. And then we did our show and then we had a big conversation about it. It was brilliant. The scientists were all crying because they are scientists and they hadn't considered the subjective reality of all the lonely people that they were interviewing. And they, which was brilliant because I think there's a sort of slight bias in society that science is somehow better. But I've never, you know, I believe in art, otherwise I wouldn't do it. I believe in its power and its necessity. And the fact that they kind of endorsed that by how they were reacting to the show. But what I found out, which absolutely stunned me, was that until, okay, I don't want to lie, 2005, I think, the protocol, if you went to your doctor and were brave enough to go, I am so lonely, help, was to go to social skills training. Which is, I mean, what the actual fuck, because... We now know that lonely people do not necessarily have shit social skills. They don't. And that's where the shame comes from, because obviously you start saying I'm lonely and they're like, you know, all failure. My friends were, oh, great. We thought you were cool. This is what, they didn't say this, but in their faces I could see like, oh. Ooh,
cringy, needy.
We thought you were like, right, but, But to have added to that, being sent to social skills training, I mean, weirdly, it doesn't work. Because, I mean, it might work if you need to reframe a bit and not see your interactions as hostile when they're just neutral. Mm. And that's where a more of a CBT mindfulness approach is useful. But to be taught, hello, smile, eye contact, hello. I mean, it's just adding shame to shame.
It's just, and it's also... Horrifying,
and it didn't fucking work. So these people were going to, you know, going obediently to their social skills training and feeling worse and feeling less connected and feeling more inadequate. And
I would say that is like the most depressing thing I've heard.
Yeah, but isn't it brilliant? This is what I mean, like how kind of cutting edge our knowledge of loneliness is, because that wasn't a, yeah, and now it's like, no, that's not, but the might, I mean, I take the piss out of mindfulness in the show as well, because for me it's just like the NHS is fucked, we can't afford to treat you, so here's an app.
And, I was told there's okay, so I went and, okay, first of all, I have my child with me, because where else was he supposed to be, and I'm talking to the GP about like I'm really depressed, like I'm like, in, well, how suicidal, it was sort of an interview, like, yeah, and like, how suicidal are you? Yeah, exactly, like...
Well, in front of Dexter?
Yeah.
Great.
So, like, how suicidal, and I was like, but it was also, like, an interview, like, I had to prove I was upset, and she's like, well, this says, well, you're not, you know, depressed enough for therapy, but wow. We'll give you this
mindfulness
beating... Beating the blues.
Uh-huh.
Fuck you. The blues. Beating the blues.
That's a very... Program only I was women have to do, the blues. Only was, women have the blues.
I was supposed to do on the computer by myself.
Yeah.
Fuck you. I didn't even start it.
No,
I
was sure. Like, no, why would you?
Thank you, no.
Why would you?
Like, I failed at being depressed. Excellent. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
This was awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. We gotta change this stuff.
Yeah.
And thank you, Annie Siddons, for opening up this incredibly important conversation.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a piece of theatre before it's anything else. It just happens to be about some stuff.
But, and it's funny. Go see it.
It's so funny. Do you want me to say where it's on? And like,
yes.
So it's on at the Soho Theatre from tomorrow until Saturday.
Tomorrow being Tuesday.
And the
August
Soho,
29th.
Yeah, and Soho Theatre has a website, which is, I think, sohotheatre.com or .uk, and you can get tickets from there. And then we're touring the show all over the UK from November onwards. Because of my other responsibilities, it's a bit patchy, so we're doing like two dates. It's not like one big tour, but we're doing a lot of dates because obviously people outside London get lonely too, and they need to see good theatre. So,
and they can see those dates
on my website, which is anniesiddons.co.uk.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Annie Siddons.
Pleasure.